Welcome to Personal Political, 4 episodes of critical audio storytelling. Each episode was produced by students in the course Poetics and Politics of Nonfiction Audio Storytelling at Hampshire College. For the final assignment, each student produced a duet for the intimate and the political. They were asked to look at something in their life that's very alive for them, and to kind of dive into the intimacy of that experience or story or wound or trauma or joy, and then also look at it through a political lens as well. So they're making a duet between the two. So this is an experiment in combining sound, voice, autoethnography, poetry, and critical storytelling. Welcome to Personal Political. Episode 1, Lives in Transition.
Heat Off the Blacktop by Malik Ford.
My mom used to always say, be home before the street light comes on. If it beats you, we're going to have problems. I never thought anything of it. I thought it was just a parent being a parent, an overbearing source of authority. I never thought those same precautions would be the ones that affected my life. Living in a small city called Fort Wayne, Indiana.
My beer, G. Nah, but that's me. I don't know what you thought.
Bro, you the fuck around, clown.
Nah, that's my shit. My G, what the f?
Bro, stop being the whole bitch.
And nah, man, I see your chest getting swollen, bro. What you try to do? What's good?
Bro, you're not gonna do shit, though.
Where?
I'm not on shit, bro. I'm not gonna merch that shit.
Where? We'll see, nigga.
Bang bang, my baby shot me down.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question: do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Where I'm from? Confrontation is a part of life. Most people can seek it or avoid it, but stiffen you. Confrontation is a means of respect, a sense of space. When that space is breached, we see the result of a process of erupted emotion. At times, confrontation can be life-ending.
So we have had 23 homicides so far this year total in Allen County. As we mentioned, 22 within the city of Fort Wayne.
22 homicides across the city of Fort Wayne. On the map where you see a red dot is where someone has been shot and killed. These are the people who have died. 30 people died last year. The math is simple. Last year, once every 12 days, someone was shot and killed. This year, once every week. If the violence persists, we're on pace to have 50 homicides by the end of the year. We would be 7 shy of what Boston saw last year, and we would have more than Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Minneapolis, and Buffalo saw last year.
This gang is known as the Mob Street Gang. These members have had a violent history here in the city.
The worst is when that heat comes off the blacktop. Those dark and jaded alleyways. Cracks and crevices in the street. Representing years of neglect from forgotten people. The heat elevates. The blood courses through your veins faster. The corn syrup poison used to cool you off on a hot summer day kickstarts your heartbeat. It starts to pound through your chest, sprinting out your body with reckless abandon. The mist in the air fills your nostrils with a strange smell of tar. This is when decisions become lofty. When the irritation is present throughout the day. When the heat comes off the blacktop, your life could end.
The first time I saw a gun was when I was 8. I don't think it was loaded. It was a snub nose, all black. I stared at it as if it mirrored me. But I didn't recognize it. It didn't resemble me. I could still feel the sting from the wooden drawer as I shut my hand in it after hearing a loud, "What are you doing?" from my grandfather. That's when I knew guns weren't just toys. "Don't play with that. Don't do that." Voices reach out to me to protect me. Silly. Guns were everywhere. Video games, movies, TV. 3 blocks from my school.
"Yo, kid, come over here. You want this?"
Probably most prevalent was the music.
"Check it out, look. I bet. Yeah, that's 50. Yeah, 50.
Something about music makes people lose their minds. Combine that with the heat. It's the bass is the most important. You gotta have, like, I don't know. It's something about that bass, man. It takes up space. It's like, it's definitely the bass. Like, if any party, any neighborhood function, or just like daily, you gotta have, like, it's like a competition. People blast their music until their license plate falls off. Like, you'll have a car, like a 98 hoopty, like Chrysler Mercury, you could barely afford, but you've got good speakers. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's like, people respect that. So it's like a competition who can have their speakers blast louder, no matter what whip you're in, really. So, but I don't know, music's just a way to stroll through your neighborhood. For those 3 minutes, you're like royalty. Just watch where you go. I mean, because blasting music through someone else's neighborhood is like, it's like really disrespectful. Like, people get shot for that shit. The boys asked us, "How does it feel to be a problem?" Whose problem? Ours? Is our self-worth still measured by their profits off us? Is the value of your life calibrated by Earth's axis as it grants you another day before they take it? Before we take it. Fort Wayne used to be called the city of churches. Couldn't walk down the street without seeing a church. Couldn't walk down the street without seeing people draped in their Sunday's best. Walking hand in hand. Their devotion to God was a means of hope. Fort Wayne. City of hope. But look to your left. Then they made that gun store in Pettit. Now you can buy a Glock on Anthony. Now you can buy a pistol on Bowser. Now they profit off us killing us.
When do we let them do this to us? When do we let them do this to us?
When ordinary hands can possess such an extraordinary instrument, that symbolizes the full measure of human dignity and liberty. This year, to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
No Simple Kind of Love by Emma Leff with Vipassana Green. The advantages of not being a male artist.
Working without the pressure of success.
Having the opportunity to choose between career and motherhood.
Knowing your career might pick up after you're 80.
Not having to undergo the embarrassment of being called a genius.
Not having to be in shows with men.
Seeing your ideas live on in the works of others.
Being included in revised versions of art history.
Being reassured that whatever kind of art you make, it will be labeled feminine.
I love you. I love, and so there was you. I love the stage. I love, and so there was the stage. I love leaving. I love, and so there was leaving.
Can I ask you a question first?
Please.
And this is going to, like, maybe sound dumb. But, like, do you think that we have, like, a mentor-mentee relationship?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's foggy all week for weeks when we sit on your porch and you smoke cigarettes while you tell me you love me. It's no simple kind of love. I didn't always know. It was winter when we first met and I was making plays in your bed, wet and unknowing. Your friends called me by your name. We look alike out of the corner of the eye. Same sketch of a body. Pencil on paper makes no noise. I did not tell you I wanted to be your friend the way I did. Brutally and lovelily, lace-like and darkly, the way I do. I am somewhat savage in my love now, even when I am silent. But then I am blushing in your bed. I was flushed in front of the camera, in your pajamas. I love you like this.
Like, I feel like the night that I saw Careful Now, I think, was probably, like, where our friendship got, like, much more real and intense. I don't think I've ever gotten, like, a more meaningful text than this text you sent me after that. Like, after seeing something that, like, moved me more than, like, a lot of theater that I've seen, like, and then having you tell me that part of me was in that, like, that's, like, unreal.
Like, I would have moments over the process of creating Careful Now where I'd be like, oh, like, I know exactly, like, where I got this from, and it was you.
All of the, like, most important directing principles or, like, notes that I have or give, like, I remember the moment that that was given to me. That's really cool that I, like, have someone who thinks of me when they give a note. I don't know if that, like...
No, that's exactly...
Yeah.
The relationship that, like... I've said this before, but, like, that younger, like, students at Hampshire, especially theater students, I think, have with older students that get formed is, like, yeah, a thing. And, like, yeah, so many people have it.
It was Easter morning, and I was drunk in the woods looking for you, stumbling in snow and mud and fallow field, and I don't remember everything, but I was happy to stumble into your arms. And I am always tagging along like I did that shining dawn, the trees telling me to hold tight to you and your genius, and I did not hear them, or maybe I did not know, until I am making things without you, singing songs of my own, that sound a lot like the ones you sing. I think I love the way my voice sounds now. Fragile harmonies, sounds like caring, sounds like seed in the low notes growing whole. Sounds like I love you. And I do not know what song I could sing to tell you so. I am no soprano. You are cracking your knuckles, and I am young. God, I am so young. Feels like I won't ever catch up in height or in the right words. The world sounds stupid falling out of my mouth. Can't stuff it back in once it's breathed the cold air. I won't ever know how there are always the right words spooled in your mouth. Could drown in them. Sometimes I want to.
So you're graduating. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like my question. Not necessarily.
So you're graduating?
So you're no.
Are you?
No big deal. But like, what does that mean for us moving forward?
I don't know. I was thinking the other day about how like I don't like how I don't like not knowing if I'll be able to come see your and Kevin's show. And then I realized that there's 2 years till your Div 3. And then I was like, will I be able to / will I want to come see Emma's Div 3? And I also don't imagine that I will, like, come back to visit.
Yeah.
But, like, this is gonna, like, sound, like, dumb. But, like, I kind of think, like, to a certain degree, like, again, this is gonna sound ridiculous, to a certain degree it doesn't matter if we stay friends because like this has been really important and mm-hmm. That's like unquestionable. On the other hand, it would be great if we were still friends. Yeah. So
it matters to me.
I'm not saying it doesn't matter, like you gotta know what I mean.
It is the early morning, still night, and there is no fog when you tell me you are proud of me without saying so. And it is too warm for February, and I know from your arms around me, you see the songs I am singing, with difficulty sometimes, or the songs I have yet to sing. You may or may not be around to hear them, but they sound like fog in my chest. The two of us on your porch, breathing strong, bright in the dark, our two voices smoking our breath away.
And this is going to sound like weird, but like I didn't have somebody like me. It's like really cool for me to look at like you and like all of these women that especially like this year, I feel self-conscious saying this, but, like, I know I've had a really big impact on, like, as, like, a woman making theater here at Hampshire.
I think I remember, like, during Unapologetic, Emily saying, like, Vipassana says that, like, last year you were her, meaning me, were her first year baby, and, like, this year it's me. Like,
oh, I remember you being like, I still want to be your baby.
That's true. Well, and it's interesting because, like, I've been thinking about this and the fact that, like, people call me Little MLF and, like, stuff like that, that, like, I'm always, like, trying to fight against the idea of being little or small or, like, I don't know. I feel like people see me kind of diminutively sometimes.
Well, I think the thing that I meant with that is that, like, you were my first year baby and, like, you became my collaborator this year.
Well, yeah. And I think that I also felt much better about being like someone's baby or like being like little because I knew that there were bigger people.
Yeah.
And, like, that like me like that I fit into the scheme of something that I was comfortable fitting in. Yeah. Like that,
I don't know, like you don't idolize me. I think that you like to speak for you, like
that's fine,
maybe look up to me in a way that also includes the bad parts of me. Yeah. Which is really incredible because I think like it reminds me of things I have to offer to other people or like parts of myself that I don't think about, but then I can see them because you let me. I don't want to put that on you in terms of like I am your mentor, but like I've thought about that a lot.
I think about it too, and especially because, like, I, as, like, a high schooler, had a lot of, like, really...
Like, you talk about mentorship a lot, yeah.
And I also think that, like, the person who I would call my mentor from high school, like, would definitely be uncomfortable to hear me say that word. Sort of was able to put my finger on that, like, that, like, with you, I was like, oh, like, she can be my mentor, but also, like, my friend, and I can be her friend.
Yeah.
And, like, that was, like, a really important thing, because I was like, oh, like, this is what this feels like in a good way, or, like, when I know where I'm going with it.
The advantages of not being a male artist.
Being reassured that whatever kind of art you make, it will be labeled feminine.
Having the opportunity to choose between career and motherhood.
Having to escape from the art world in your 4 freelance jobs.
Being included in revised versions of art history.
Not having to undergo the embarrassment of being called a genius.
Seeing your ideas live on in the works of others.
Not being stuck in a tenured teaching position.
My Almost Superpower by Ashley Monty Montgomery. Content warning for cutting.
So, flying, endurance, telekinesis. In the simplest terms, those are my abilities. Rather, the ones I would have if this was real. Some say that superhero comics and stories are modern-day myths, the same way the Greeks had Zeus and Kronos, and the Romans had Mars and Jupiter. We have Batman and Captain America. And like all myths, there are 2 main reasons to tell these stories over and over again. To explain the world around us, or to escape the world around us. But what are we escaping from?
Our unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from
the
college
children
kids,
have been infected with a little-known and dangerous strain of bacteria called E. coli 0157, which lives in the cow's intestines. Bill Marler would represent many of them in lawsuits against Jack in the Box.
It varies, to say the least. For me, a flight above the city really gives me perspective. Soaring over skyscrapers downtown and gaudy towers. I do it because it's the only time I'm above all this rich stuff. And partially because my wings are very noticeable. Did I not mention them? Yeah, they're a little weird. These giant speckled brown hawk-like wings spread out of my shoulder blades one day. It was painful, and I even tried cutting them off, but they just grew back. They don't hurt as much anymore, and I can control them, make them invisible when need be. They're also cheaper than taking the subway. I guess what I'm escaping from is spending money. When I put on this mask and costume, I'm a different person. This author named Danny Fingeroth once asked, "Is it better to be who you are, or who you pretend you are?" Superheroes, let us be both. Escapism is a psychological drive. It pushes people toward entertainment and other distractions as a form of escape from the unpleasantries of one's own life. But it's not as selfish as it sounds, believe me. Escapism can help us become better people and learn about ourselves. Take Captain America, for instance, the story where a scrawny kid from Brooklyn with almost every ailment imaginable becomes a super soldier with the help of a serum. But it isn't the serum that makes him a hero. It's his heart.
The serum amplifies everything that is inside. So good becomes great. Bad becomes worse. This is why you were chosen. Because a strong man who has known power all his life may lose respect for that power. But a weak man knows the value of strength and knows compassion.
Thanks, I think.
Whatever happens tomorrow, you must promise me one thing. That you will stay who you are. Not a perfect soldier, but a good man.
Good becomes great, bad becomes worse. Take me, for example. I could easily use my powers for evil. Not take over the world evil, but probably petty theft and small crime. Capitalism is definitely something superheroes help us escape, in one of two ways. Giving us coming-of-age origin stories like Superman and Captain America, or giving us a rich, powerful guy who uses his privilege for good. Ooh, Iron Man is on. That's another great thing about superheroes. They show normal people how we can rise above our circumstances, but also how powerful people can actually help others in the world. In both real and fictional worlds, money for the lower class is not a source of power. In fiction, superpower is power. In reality, money for the lower class isn't power. It's survival. It's scary not being able to provide for yourself and your family's safety. In reality, my alter ego is almost done with college. And then what comes next after graduation? I'm not sure. The question isn't, what do you want to do with your life? But rather, how can you monetize your talents, your labor? I've lived with my mom for most of my life. She's part of the working class. Growing up, I got books from the library. On birthdays, I'd ask for batteries or stationery. For the expensive stuff, I'd ask my dad. It was never spoken out loud, but it's always there. This other. This lack. My father's family are professionals, mostly of engineering. They look down on me because I majored in English instead of a STEM, just like my mom. But Dad, if you could experience the creation of words, transportation to very real worlds I couldn't even afford to fathom, maybe you could see this view from my perspective. How could I do something realistic when reality sucks so bad? When I was born into something subordinate and expected to work so hard to rise above it? Hours studying, the library, my second home free of capitalism, earning spots at the best schools, for what? For what? A life half lived? A life approved of by you, by them, by everyone else? But me? Sorry. Sorry. Life is too expensive for people like me. We either kill ourselves working so hard to live the way the world approves of, or we find a way to live a doomed life, a lower life. I'm alive in fiction and superheroes. I exist because of libraries, and capitalism is the doomsday trying to vanquish them. Ironic, isn't it? My very existence here and in reality, is in opposition to capitalism. And yet I need money to save the libraries, save others, save myself. I don't have the right powers. Hello? What? Where? On my way. I can't give you an answer for capitalism. I can barely afford this part-time saving gig. All I know is, here, with every life saved, every adventure complete, I get to exist in a way that my real life doesn't allow me, in a way I can't realistically afford. In this mask, I am me, or at the very least, the me I pretend to be.
Mentally Sound by Eli Salas Kleiner.
When I was 19, I went to my uncle's house in rural Oregon for a week to help him with some work on his farm. He lives in an old farmhouse that's been in my family for 4 generations. I stayed in the bedroom upstairs that smelled like dust and old furniture, but I didn't sleep. I didn't want to sleep, and I couldn't if I tried. I smoked pot. I walked around the farm with my uncle's dog, Daisy, in the middle of the night. I recorded music, I listened to music, and I cried with joy. Mania is hard to describe, but I'll do my best. I thought I was the second coming of Jesus Christ. I thought I was the most talented musician alive, and I thought that all the most powerful people in the music industry were scouting me through the internet. I thought I would be a breakout sensation within a couple weeks. I thought I had been chosen by some divine force to spread messages of peace and love through my music. After years of depression and anxiety and confusion, I finally felt pure. I cried when I thought about my parents or my ex-girlfriend or my aunt and uncle or anyone else with whom I shared love. I felt like I was on top of the world. I thought I was a superhuman, and I wondered why I ever needed to sleep at all. I felt smarter and more interesting and more perceptive than I ever had before. And I thought everyone around me saw it too. In reality, they saw someone they cared about coming unhinged, losing touch with reality. At my uncle's, my brain and heart worked overtime during the night when I felt like Jesus Christ. But during the day, I mostly lounged on the couch and complained. My uncle hired me to help him, and I didn't even notice that I wasn't giving him the help he needed. I was so out of touch that I didn't notice the signs that everyone I loved was concerned about me. My parents found a doctor who specialized in bipolar disorder, and they convinced me to go. Soon, I crashed into the deepest depression of my life. It lasted 9 months or so. I slept for 12 hours or more every day. I had a job at a chain restaurant working weekends. My shift started at 11 p.m., and I would ride my bike home at around 4 a.m. I usually woke up after the sun had set and ate junk food and watched TV in the living room. After a while, the doctor found the right combination of meds, and I started to feel better. I got a better job and some healthy relationships. I applied for college, and I got in. I haven't had a manic episode in 5 years now, and I'm grateful every day for that. A lot of people aren't as lucky as I've been. Bipolar disorder reduces people's lifespan by 9.2 years on average, and as many as 1 in 5 people diagnosed with the disease commit suicide. I've thought about suicide, but I've never tried it, because I found a doctor who helped pull me out of my depression before it ever got to that point. But what would I have done if my parents weren't around to help, or if we didn't have the money for treatment, or if there wasn't treatment available in the first place? Mental illness is a huge taboo in this culture. When you admit that you're struggling, you risk being ostracized and maybe losing your job. People with mental illnesses are often seen as weak or scary. So this taboo, along with the US's broken healthcare system, leads to the fact that around 60% of adults with a mental illness didn't receive treatment in the previous year. So I am really lucky, but it's not just blind luck. I'm a middle-class white male, and I have access to things that a lot of people don't. Like, for example, African Americans and Hispanic Americans use mental health services at about half the rate of white people. And that isn't because of individual choice, and it doesn't mean African Americans and Hispanic Americans don't struggle with mental illnesses like white people do. No, the discrepancy is because of systemic, institutionalized discrimination that limits access to treatment for some people while making it easier for others. Struggling with mental health can mean homelessness and criminalization and death. I avoided all of those, and I need to push myself to be constantly aware of the privilege that allows me to lead a relatively stable life, while so many others cannot. It's really easy to take my privilege for granted. It's easy to see my recovery as the result of blind luck or my own strong will to thrive. But it's not the result of these things, because there are so many people in this country and around the world who don't receive the care they deserve because they don't have access to it. These thoughts can be uncomfortable because they require acknowledging that I have more social power than tons of other people just because of my skin color and the environment I was born into. But this is the truth, and I can't do any work to change these power structures if I'm not aware of the role I play in keeping them alive. I got help even though I didn't know I needed it. What if there was no one there to help? Now I'm about to graduate from college. My moods still swing, but I'm a lot healthier than I once was, and I'm not delusional anymore, I don't think. I just hope I can keep holding on.
Thank you for listening to episode 1 of Personal Political. We're going to get to hear from 3 of our producers, and I'm going to ask a question of them. I'm Karen Werner, by the way. And so I'm going to first ask Malik Ford, the producer of the first piece we heard, Heat Off the Blacktop. Is that the right title?
Yes, that's it.
So, Malik, in the process of making this piece, you did several drafts, as everyone did in the class.
Mm-hmm.
Did you come to learn anything about yourself or see the intimate issue you were exploring in a new way by seeing it through a kind of both personal and political lens?
Yeah, I noticed that when it comes to audio and less visual aspects that I've been working on in school, I have a harder time really listening to myself and delving in and criticizing myself positively. So it's really hard to really try to go deeper into what I was really trying to say with the political aspect and the emotional aspect. And it took about 3 or 4 or more iterations to really get down to what I was trying to say and not have it be like a PowerPoint presentation. So, I definitely grew having getting like more in touch with my inner self through audio. And I think, as you said earlier in the class, I think audio really like captures that more so than any other form. So,
great. Great. Thanks. So now we're going to hear from Emma Leff. Emma, what was the title of your piece again? The second piece that we heard in this episode?
No Simple Kind of Love.
Lovely. No Simple Kind of Love. So, Emma, I have the same question for you. Did you learn anything about yourself in the process of making this and or through the kind of activity of looking at this intimate issue also through a political lens?
I think that something that I knew but hadn't named was what one of the things that like being in a mentorship relationship does, which is I think sort of like understanding that someone like loves the parts of you that you don't even love, and then that helps you love those parts of you. So that's something I think that I was able to articulate and discover and uncover more throughout the process of making the piece.
Beautiful. Great. Thank you. Well done. And now we're going to hear from the producer of the third piece that we heard. And Monty, this is Monty Montgomery. What was the name of your piece again? Remind us.
My Almost Superpower.
Wonderful. Same question for you. The process of making this piece, what did you learn about yourself, including by looking at some intimate issues also through a political lens?
I didn't realize this when I started the first rough draft of this piece, but I learned by now how uncomfortable I am with explicitly expressing my personal feelings and situation for the public. As a person who considers herself very introspective, I feel like I know myself pretty well, but trying to like articulate it into words or audio was a very much part of the struggle when doing this. So escapism, which was like my personal troubles, just seemed the most natural way to go about it and like try to get as close to the issue, but as far away from it as possible.
Wonderful. That's great. Lots of head nodding here. I saw Malik nodding also. Great. Thank you so much. It was a really beautiful first episode.